I'm speaking with Aarti Shahani. Aarti is the co-founder of Families for Freedom in New York City. Families for Freedom was established in 2002, and it's a multi-ethnic defense network by and for immigrants facing and fighting deportation. It's made up of immigrant prisoners, former immigrant prisoners, their loved ones, or individuals at risk of deportation. Aarti, thanks for joining us on No One's Legal Radio.
Thank you.
Aarti, I want you to give our listeners a bit of perspective about the network of detention for migrants in the United States. At any given point in time, it seems like there's hundreds of thousands of people in detention who are migrants. Could you give our listeners some of an overview of the network of immigrant detention in the United States?
Sure. Well, to give context, the United States already has a very well-known culture of incarceration. We incarcerate more people than any other country in the world. There are over 2 million people locked up in this country on any given day. Immigrant prisoners are the fastest growing segment of the domestic prison population. So what that means is that every day as the prison industry continues to grow in this country, through private prison expansion and through county jails hungry for more and more contracts, increasingly the physical bodies, the human bodies filling up the beds, are the bodies of immigrants. So on any given day at this point, there are anywhere from 22,000 to 25,000 immigrants being detained in federal deportation proceedings. These detentions are nationwide. So to give a typical trajectory, I work in New York. Let's say someone from Brooklyn is arrested one day, processed through through the system, and put into immigration detention. What will happen is that person from Brooklyn will be transferred to a facility in Lower Manhattan, and then within a few days, sent off to a facility in New Jersey. A few days after that, down to possibly Oakdale, Louisiana, not too far from New Orleans, where the hurricane had hit. And then from there, possibly to a small parish prison in Alabama. That's a very typical sort of path for migrants who are being detained. And what's extraordinary about it from our standpoint as family members facing this stuff is that people don't call us to let us know Homeland Security is sending your loved one here one day, there the next. So it's really impossible to know where your loved one is without doing a whole lot of legwork. Like I know just today, for example, I spent probably 45 minutes or an hour just trying to track someone down who had been set through this type of path I just described. And there, nationwide, there are over 250 facilities that contract out immigrant detainees. So it is a federal system where people are bounced around left and right without very very many rights.
Could you speak more about the actual conditions faced by the detainees that you're describing?
Sure. I mean, conditions are pretty horrendous, and I think that no one's really made to be locked up. Human beings don't do too well when they're incarcerated, and I don't think jail is supposed to really be fit for us. But what happens in immigration detention, it's interesting because you have different types of facilities that contract out with Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security, which formed after 9/11, that took over the immigration functions of the federal government, goes ahead and it contracts detention beds with different types of facilities because it's not as though there are enough federal prisons to hold detainees. So they go ahead to county jails and private prisons. Now, the private prison industry is actually pretty notorious, and it's well known that after 9/11, CEOs of Wackenhut Corrections, private prison corporation, actually went ahead and celebrated the fact of the towers falling as being good for business. But apart from that private prison sector that's clearly lobbying for more and more bed space or contracts, county jails are increasingly relying on immigrant detainees as a cash crop. So what happens is that county jails that are in small, random little parishes scattered around the country don't have enough money to sustain themselves. There aren't enough local inmates coming in to fill up the beds. So, down in, for example, Gadsden, Alabama, thousands of miles away from New York, we have a bunch of members who are being detained over there. Just today, for example, we spent some time writing a letter of concern to the warden at Gadsden, the officer in charge, the Department of Homeland Security, the ACLU, just writing to a whole lot of governmental and non-governmental agencies about the fact that people down in Gadsden detained over there don't have any access to the law libraries. They're being denied their mail. They're, by and large, doing their own litigation. The fact is, in deportation, you're not given a lawyer, so you have to represent yourself. people become experts of the law de facto, and they have to go ahead and fend for themselves. So one of our members down there is doing just that, but they're really stripping him of that basic ability to even fight. So, you know, one thing that happens a lot is that the few rights that you do have get stripped away from you while you're detained. And that's not just incidental, and it's not by accident. The fact is, detention is a cornerstone of the government strategy to uproot our communities. When you're detained, it's a lot harder to fight. You're farther away from your family, from any emotional support. It's physically and spiritually really taxing. And they use that. You know, I know, for example, I had a good friend who was detained in a county jail in New Jersey for 2 years. And for the first year, actually, he's Haitian, he hadn't seen sunlight or breathes fresh air for a full year because they weren't given any outdoor recreation. And it's not because the facility couldn't do it. The facility was able to give outdoor recreation, and their regular local inmates went outdoors, but they decided that immigration detainees were going to be kept inside the whole time. So for over a year, there was no direct sunlight, no fresh air. And I think that type of stuff, it's torture. You know, just to give one more example, another woman who's a part of the organization, she's a young woman who was actually detained for 3 years in 7 different facilities around the country. And her crime for which she was being deported was smoking a marijuana joint when she was 17 years old. She got detained when she was a little over 18, spent multiple birthdays inside. She was held in this one really nasty facility in Pennsylvania with a whole bunch of other women. And you can imagine, you not to be too graphic, but being a woman and having to menstruate while you're inside and not having proper sanitary napkins or tampons or anything for hygiene, and then on top of that having male officers look at you while you're showering, which was what happened in her case. Like, literally, they couldn't use a toilet without having a male officer look and peer in. But besides that sort of human degradation that happened on a daily, you know, basis, one day there was a scare in the facility, and everyone thought a fire went off. The smoke alarms went off. You know, everything was ringing, everything was chaotic. And rather than evacuating the women from that facility, the guards shut them down. They locked them down in the facility. And so everyone thought that they were going to burn alive. Turned out that it wasn't a fire. It was actually a false alarm. But after that, the women weren't allowed to use the telephones for a few weeks because the officers didn't want them to contact their family and let them know what had happened inside.
Families for Freedom refers to the war on immigrants and refers to deportation as apartheid. I'm just wondering if you could flesh out those concepts a bit, the idea that there's a war against immigrant communities, which sort of, for mainstream people, I guess, is sort of counterintuitive insofar as the U.S. is supposed to be welcoming to migrants.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, within the United States and outside of it, imagine the sort of myth of migration where the U.S. just sort of opens its arms to the huddling masses or whatever they call it. But in fact, the U.S. government is invested pretty deeply in policing people based on migration status. We refer to what's happening in this country as apartheid for a few reasons. And it's not to say that it's the only form of structural discrimination in the United States. There are many forms of it. But what's interesting, if you look at this country, for example, it's no longer lawful to legislate against people based on their race. So if you look at the letter of the law, it's not as though you can lawfully in Congress enact special laws for black people and special laws for white people. That language is no longer explicitly allowed. Increasingly, immigrants in this country are black and brown. And as that happens to be the case, we see increasingly Congress using migration status as a way to police people based on race. So in New York, for example, you know, it's a well-known fact that plenty of black New Yorkers actually come from Caribbean ancestry or are first-generation Caribbean themselves. Now, what happens to typical New York, I mean, racial profiling happens all over the place. NYPD has quite a reputation. When you have your basic stop and frisk, for example, in Flatbush, Brooklyn, NYPD will go ahead and arrest you. You'll go through the criminal system. You'll be, you know, sort of pressured to take a plea. It happens all the time. Whether you're guilty or not, and regardless of what you might be guilty of, you go ahead and you're pressured to take a plea. And then for, you know, in the typical scenario, that would sort of be the end of it, and you'd be released from the system. And then you'd go through felony disenfranchisement or whatnot, lose housing, lose education benefits. But what's happening increasingly is that as black and brown communities are increasingly non-citizen communities, the consequences of a stop and frisk, the consequences of policing is changing. And it's becoming not just stop and frisk, but stop, frisk, and deport. And so you see in the basic law enforcement in this country, I mean, it's well known that the U.S. is really a culture of policing and incarceration. The fact is this country is engineering ways to surveil communities and exporting it throughout the Americas, throughout Latin America. It's, you know, you have, for example, Giuliani, the former mayor of New York, traveling throughout the Dominican Republic and El Salvador, exporting what he calls, you know, New York-style policing. But to turn back to this point of apartheid, our analysis is that the government is using immigration status as a way to legally, economically, and socially target people. It's deeply racialized. And that targeting, it's de facto and it's de jure. So it's written into the letter of the law, and increasingly, besides just the letter of the law, you can see, you know, media using images of migration and immigrants in a really prejudiced and discriminatory way. You can see law enforcement agencies around the country, without Congress even dictating it, going ahead and assuming the responsibilities of immigration enforcement. So you have suddenly all of these cities around the United States deciding they are going to be immigration police. So even if you might be in the Midwest, you might be up north, you might be far away from the Mexico-U.S. border, the border is following itself into the interior through public servants around the country taking it upon themselves. So you really see a transformation in the very fabric of our society. And the reason we're so explicit about calling this transformation apartheid is because there is a struggle in the U.S. to figure out how to respond to this system. There's a struggle to figure out, are we fighting against something that's just an aberration, some sort of quick post 9/11 drama that we can heal and move away from, or is there something deeper? And I think that, you know, unfortunately, over the last 10 or 20 years, the government has decided it's going to invest in policing migration. It's been clear well before 9/11, and the patterns are just continuing.
One thing we've learned here in Montreal over the years of immigrant rights organizing is that the survival of migrants, especially migrants who are detained, sort of stands as an inspiration for how we should be acting in the streets and in our organizing, but also that there is resistance within the walls of detention centers and outside. And I'm wondering if you could share with us some of those examples of resistance and survival that Families for Freedom has experienced and lived through in your organizing since 2002.
Definitely. I mean, I'd say that. You know, our collective experience has been one of needing to survive and needing to struggle and needing to fight just because, like, you know, when you're up against the wall, you sort of don't have a choice. But then besides that, you know, I'd say that deportation is probably the most radicalizing experience most of our members have ever been through. I can say that for myself personally. When my uncle was deported and when my dad was taken, and that was definitely a shocker to me. But it wasn't just paralyzing, and I don't really buy that. You know, people are too afraid to fight back. Communities are in fear and they can't fight back. I think, in fact, these types of experiences make you fight even harder and smarter. You know, I was mentioning before the fact of getting this letter from Etowah County Jail of a detainee over there. The fact is the detainee who wrote to us from down there has been detained for several years, and he's an amazing jailhouse lawyer. And, like, that's a phenomenon that pops up all over the place, is people that stay inside or locked up inside and decide, you know what, I'm going to use the tools of the law as best I can to keep fighting and to make sure I write to every organization under the sun to make sure people keep that visibility. And I think that part of our struggle is to make sure that people that are locked up inside actually have some sort of, like, you know, network around them so that government agencies that, you know, that would want to ignore them understand they can't, because there is actually a community outside that's voicing the same concerns and documenting what's going on. So it's really recreating community where the government's trying to destroy it. But I think besides that, you know, one campaign that we have that I'm actually really proud of, there are two campaigns that I'm really proud of, but one campaign is actually an effort to target foreign governments through their consulates and embassies to intervene in the U.S. deportation process on behalf of their nationals. What does that mean? Right now, deportation is an interesting form of punishment. This is true for Canada. It's true for the U.S. Whenever you deport a migrant, it's not just the sending country that's expelling. There is a receiving country that has to actively take the migrant in. And right now, in our experience, receiving countries, by and large, just facilitate deportations, just rubber stamp the Department of Homeland Security request for deportation documents, rather than examining cases and actually advocating for the nationals that are detained. So one thing that we've done, you know, through our membership, knowing about the power of foreign consulates and their ability to intervene and being at the doors of their own consulates left and right, you know, sort of constantly, we basically started a campaign to start getting our consulates and our embassies to proactively help in situations of detention abuse, in situations of illegal or premature deportation, and identifying where our members may be when we can't find them in the system, of doing a whole lot of things. And so I would say that, you know, that campaign actually came out of a Jamaican member of ours. He was in detention. He was actually in criminal incarceration before being put in detention. And while he was incarcerated, a guard actually crushed his skull with a gate. And he suffered permanent brain damage, now has seizures regularly, is clearly disabled. And after going through that in the criminal system and being put into the immigration system for deportation, his wife went to the Jamaican embassy and the consulate, and she was like, listen, this government, the United States, destroyed my husband, and now you're going to try to send him to a place where he clearly won't even be able to work or have a living or support himself? This is completely inhumane. How can you do this? And in response, the Jamaican government actually intervened and said, you know what, I'm not sure that we can on humanitarian grounds. And so he was ultimately released from detention. Now, mind you, he's still fighting a deportation case, but the fact of his country actually intervening and speaking out became an inspiration for us about, you know, what can governments do? Right now, the immigration debate is very hot in the United States. There have been a lot of popular mobilizations and a lot of strategizing going on. What's really interesting to me is when you look, for example, at Vicente Fox and the standpoint of the Mexican government, they can do so much more than they are doing to actually advocate for their nationals here. Vicente Fox could aggressively go ahead to the U.S. and say, you know what, we are not going to facilitate your expulsions of our migrants back to Mexico because we believe these laws are fundamentally unfair. And that, you know, that would be in compliance with various international agreements, including the Vienna Convention, that the U.S. and Mexico are signatories to. But it seems like a lot of governments are want to own responsibility, although they're very quick and ready to really, you know, piss on detainees and deportees.
My last question alludes to something that you referred to earlier, which is that human beings aren't meant to be locked up. So talking about justice within prisons is somewhat of a sort of a dead end. And I'm just wondering if you could tell our listeners about ultimately what Families for Freedom or you yourself stand for, what you're fighting for when it comes to these detention centers. There's a lot of debate about prison abolition. I'm just wondering if you could address that topic.
I can. I'll actually try to formulate some very big thoughts in my head that I've been having a hard time consolidating. And maybe they're not that big. Maybe I'm just tired. But, you know, right now in the U.S. there's a sort of conversation that I think always rears itself in various ways, but it's this whole big question about the African-American immigrant divide or unity, sort of the fact of immigrants and African-Americans have to sort of stand together. Now, I think oftentimes the way I've heard it, it's immigrant leadership talking about it as a matter of solidarity, like, oh, wouldn't it be nice and symbolic if, you know, African Americans stood beside us to speak up for civil rights across the board. But I think that there are some much deeper connections that our communities face. And I think that immigrants and African Americans don't really just need to stand together in solidarity, but, you know, out of sheer necessity, because we face a lot of the same things. I was having a conversation with some people yesterday about the prison industry and basically how deportation is simply experienced as an extension of the criminal system by the vast majority of our members. So for our members, it's people who are getting picked up for basic garden variety crimes, people who've lived here for a couple of decades, and suddenly, when they've already gone through the criminal system, experienced it, and felt really, truly, you know, exploited by it, when they think that's finally done and good, they get into this other prison system called immigrant detention for deportation purposes. But I think it's really important to not lose the fact that it's experienced as the same thing. People don't just talk about their deportation cases. They talk about how they were handled from the get-go. The complaints are the exact same as Black and Latino citizens have about the harassment by police officers and that system and felony disenfranchisement. I think apart from that, too, this question of being documented is very interesting, and the way it's going to play out in the United States, I think it's going to be much deeper than any conglomerate or corporate media would let you see right now. The first time being documented ever mattered in the United States was actually during the Fugitive Slave Act, and the first people to ever be asked for their papers were Black people who were suspected of being fugitive slaves. Okay. Now, we've come to a point in this country where being documented is clearly associated with your migration status. It's about whether you're legal or illegal. And now, more and more agencies are requiring documentation for you to receive any type of benefits that are your right, you know, under basic sort of, you know, public welfare benefits programs. So at this point, it's not just, for example, migrant labor or migrant workers or migrants that can't prove their documentation, that can't prove their status, but it's also a lot of poor African American and Latinos that simply don't have the papers, don't have the paperwork, don't have the documentation, because most people or a lot of people don't have that stuff. I was talking to someone recently about how a lot of African Americans are going to be cut from Medicaid because of the new documentation requirements they're making that specifically or supposedly in response to migration. So I guess the short answer, you know, to this question that I think is much deeper is that for Families for Freedom, our membership is overwhelmingly black and brown immigrants who come into the deportation system through the criminal system. We're very familiar with how policing has targeted our communities and torn our families apart. And I think at the end of the day, we have to have strategies that recognize the right that we have to live in our families, to have our families together and to have our communities together, to not be policed, and recognizing that that's a struggle that crosses migration status as well.
Artie, thank you very much for talking with us today on No One's Legal Radio.